Starting a new series this morning. Put this on my preaching schedule about 4 months ago, and sounded like a good idea at the time. Then it got to a couple weeks ago, and I thought, what did I get myself into? But we're gonna go with it. Song of Songs, 6-part series, 6 weeks. We're gonna finish this by the end of July. Song of Songs, we're gonna begin at chapter 1, verse 1, and read to 2, verse 3. In many of your pew Bibles, the number, page number is 1049. Just to give you a little hint what we're getting into here, I want to just ask a question. How many of you really enjoy love poetry? So that means... That's not bad. That means that there's only about 200 people here that need to be won over by this. So, like those odds. All right, let's get into it. Song of Songs, 1 verse 1. Verse 1 simply says this, Solomon's Song of Songs. Verse 2, and this is the woman or the beloved speaking. She says, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the maidens love you. Take me away with you. Let us hurry. Let the king bring me into his chambers. And here are the friends speaking. We rejoice and delight in you. We will praise your love more than wine. The woman again says, how right they are to adore you. Dark I am, yet lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem. Dark like the tents of Kedar, like the tent curtains of Solomon. Do not stare at me because I am dark, because I am darkened by the sun. My mother's sons were angry with me and made me take care of the vineyards. My own vineyard I have neglected. Tell me, you whom I love, where you graze your flock and where you rest your sheep at midday. Why should I be like a veiled woman beside the flocks of your friends? There's the friend speaking again. If you do not know, most beautiful of women, follow the tracks of the sheep and graze your young goats by the tents of the shepherds. And now, finally, we hear from the man who says, I liken you, my darling, to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. Your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your neck with strings of jewels. We will make you earrings of gold studded with silver. The woman says, while the king was at his table, my perfume spread its fragrance. My lover is to me a sachet of myrrh resting between my breasts. My lover is to me a cluster of henna blossoms from the vineyards of En-Gedi. The man says, how beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes are doves. The woman says, how handsome you are, my lover. Oh, how charming. And our bed is verdant. The man says, the beams of our house are cedars, our rafters are firs. The woman says, I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. The man says, like a lily among thorns is my darling among the maidens. And the woman says, like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my lover among the young men. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. All right, I want to introduce you this morning to this book of the Bible, the Song of Songs, sometimes called the Song of Solomon, sometimes called in Latin, for those of you who are Latin geeks, Canticum Canticorum. It is considered one of the wisdom books contained in Scripture. And by wisdom literature, we generally mean books that teach and instruct us human beings how we are to live in the practical affairs of everyday life to the glory of God. And I want to just say up front, and we'll get into this a little bit more probably in the next couple of weeks or so, but this book, I think, is useful and edifying on two different levels. First of all, it describes human love as it was meant to be expressed in the covenant of marriage. But second, it also describes in an allegorical way God's love for his people. Actually, it was kind of elected and accepted into the canon of Scripture because of the allegorical reading of Song of Songs. But, you know, apart from the allegorical reading, I think that the first reason why it is edifying is also quite valid. And we're going to kind of go back and forth both this morning and in the number of weeks to come. Because the Song of Songs has something to say about our relationships. It has something to say about courtship. It has something to say about romance. It has something to say about human sexuality, and it has something to say, of course, about love and how it is defined according to God and his design. Now, as you undoubtedly noticed, because I brought it up first and foremost, Song of Songs contains what some would call exquisite love poetry. Expressions of deep love between a man and a woman. And I want to argue that it describes love as God intended it to be, without the effects of sin, intimate, without shame, and characterized by genuine admiration and care between two marital partners, two people. See, God is brilliant in that he communicates with us at our level. Because he knows that if we are ever going to understand anything about his love for us, we need first to understand human love at its fullest potential. And we get a glimpse of it by looking at this best song ever written about it. So my goal as we study the Song of Songs is twofold. First, that our marriages, the marriages within our congregation, will gain depth and strength and become more reflective of Christ. Because one of the primary significant ways that Christ is revealed in our lives is in the intimacy and love and companionship enjoyed in our marriages. But second, that we will increase in our understanding of the relationship that we have with God, how God feels about us, how we are invited to feel about God. So as I just mentioned, this is poetry. And I say that because it kind of introduces a significant issue with regard to reading Song of Songs, namely the interpretation of it. And I found one commentator's, this is a little bit of an extended quote, but this was very helpful. It's from commentator Michael Travers. And he says this, he says, "Poetry is more intense than prose. It is briefer than prose. It has rhythm and uses physical objects as symbols. Love involves the emotions and the senses as well as the mind." How true. He goes on to write, "Prose relies on the sequence of words to develop a logical statement. But prose cannot capture love's immediacy and urgency. In short, poetry says a great deal in a few words, and it does so intensely. When we have intense emotion, we need to express it in physical terms, and poetry does that for us. So poetry is more than just pretty language. It expresses the depth and breadth of love more completely than prose could. Another factor in poetry is that it demands a response from the reader." And this is probably why this quote made it into the sermon. It demands a response from the reader. It is written to someone in particular, whereas prose is written for a general audience. In love poetry, the reader becomes the loved one. Whether we like it or not, we are forced to respond. The love poetry in the Song of Songs involves us emotionally as well as intellectually. We cannot dismiss it. End quote. Now, the first song in the Song of Songs, I know the Song of Songs is separated into eight chapters, But scholars believe that it is actually more accurately separated into six different poems or six different songs. And the first song, which we just heard, provides this series of pictures in which we are introduced to the two principal characters, okay? At different points throughout the passage, and this will be true throughout the rest of the book as well, different people are speaking. And I'll try and be very clear when that happens as I'm reading it. Sometimes it is the woman or the beloved that is speaking. Sometimes it is the lover or the man who is speaking. And sometimes it seems as though a third party or group interjects something. And these are usually identified as some unmarried friends of the woman in the song. And so first, the woman speaks to her, at this point, I would say, potential lover. In verse 2, and she says, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine." So the woman sees this man. She's seen something about him that is attractive. And so, yes, there is physical attraction here. This is something that God created in us, and it is a good thing. And her desire is stirred. We are, all of us, initially attracted to different kinds of people, and that is a good thing. I mean, if everybody was attracted to me, I mean, life would be kind of hard, right? Not that I don't wish that sometimes, but we're attracted to different kinds of people, and it's a good thing. By the way, let me just interject the allegorical interpretation here so that we can keep our minds going along two courses. This is interpreted as Israel asking God to bring her out of Egypt and into the promised land. Oh, that he would kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. And so the Song of Songs begins with this physical attraction, which is actually quite subjective because we are attracted to different kinds of people. But it quickly moves into something far more objective. Because in this poem and in the part that we read, what the woman is referring to is this man's character and his name and his reputation and his standing before others. Verse 3, "Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the maidens love you." What does she mean by this? Well, she means that everyone knew this man's character. Everyone liked this man and respected this man. He is a man of standing and a man of good reputation. And so there's something that this woman likes about this man immediately, and she refers to him as perfume poured out. And it's more than that he just smelled good, although that was important as a side note. Men rarely bathed in those times. They would pour these oils and ablutions on themselves, which hopefully covered a multitude of sins. But when the woman says this, perfume poured out is more a description of his character. The woman is obviously talking about someone whom she respects, and it's more than just physical attraction. There's standing and there's depth, even from this early moment of the relationship. So yes, there's chemistry, but there's more than chemistry. There's personality, there's depth of character, and that is important. Because I'm speaking particularly to you young people here. You should never enter into a romantic relationship with someone who you do not respect, because it will get you nowhere. Actually, I tell a lie. It will get you somewhere. It's going to get you in trouble, okay? So pay attention to that. My prayer for my daughters and my prayer for all of the daughters in this church is that you would be attracted to and end up with someone who loves God more than he loves you. Someone who has the heart of a servant. Someone that, to all who know him, is a man of standing and of character and of reputation. And let me say to you young people, you are not ready to date until that is what you want, until that is what you are looking for, whether you're a boy or whether you're a girl. Switching gears, Verses 5 and 6, the woman gives an interesting description of herself. She says, "Dark am I, yet lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, dark like the tents of Kedar, like the tent curtains of Solomon. Do not stare at me because I am dark, because I am darkened by the sun. My mother's sons were angry with me and made me take care of the vineyards. My own vineyard I have neglected." Now, what she means here is that she is tanned. And in those days, I guess, being tanned was not seen as such a good thing. She also has a problem. She speaks about the sons of her mother being angry and forcing her to go out and labor in the fields. In other words, what she's saying is that she has had a hard life, that she has suffered a little, that she has put on some city miles, if you know what I mean. And I think it's so interesting and quite beautiful, actually, that the man falls in love with someone who, at least from the world's point of view, was not such a great catch. Someone who, from the world's point of view, maybe took with her a little bit of baggage. And again, if we interpret the man in this poem as Jesus Christ and the woman as the church, how apt a description of humanity, even redeemed humanity. Because we too are a people who have had our share of suffering on account of our own sin. And we are, on account of that, maybe seen as not such a great catch. And yet Christ loves us and pursues us anyway. Well, no surprise here. The woman wants to meet the man again and asks where he rests his flocks. She does not want to appear as a veiled woman or a prostitute. She doesn't want to act in an inappropriate way. She wants to do the right thing. And then in verses 9 to 11, the man speaks to her. "I liken you, my darling, to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. Your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your neck with strings of jewels. We will make you earrings of gold studded with silver." He compares her to a horse. And just so you know, it's meant to be a compliment. You know, I had a fun time researching this, some of this stuff. What he's referring to specifically is an Egyptian horse. And apparently, Egyptian horses were the best horses in the world. And you also need to understand that ordinarily, the kind of horses that would be harnessed to one of Pharaoh's chariots, these would be stallions, okay? And so this is kind of a strange thing in this poem. In this image, he's saying this woman is like a mare among stallions, which of course would drive the stallions wild. And so maybe that's what the man means here. He's saying to her, "Oh, you just drive me wild." He's describing a physical and emotional and psychological response. Well, in verses 12 to 14, the imagery changes again. And the woman is at a banquet. She says, "While the king was at his table, my perfume spread its fragrance. My lover is to me a sachet of myrrh resting between my breasts. My lover is to me a cluster of henna blossoms from the vineyards of En-Gedi." So there's a lot of people here at this banquet, and they're drinking and eating and laughing and talking, and she and the man that she's interested in are both there, and she has eyes only for him. She's wearing a necklace, as I guess they did back then, holding a pouch full of myrrh, because women didn't bathe all that much back then either. And so that myrrh would give off a good scent and, yes, cover a multitude of sins, I would guess. And she imagines that instead of this perfume pouch hanging between her breasts, that the head of her lover would be there instead. Now, I got a real kick out of a Puritan commentator who interpreted the two breasts as representing the Old and New Testaments, and that the one lying between them was Jesus. Isn't that brilliant? Don't you love that? Moving on to her. He is like a cluster of henna blossoms in vineyards of En-Gedi. Right, that doesn't do much for me either, but En-Gedi, for those of you who don't know, is this oasis in the desert. Even today, from what I understand, because I've never been to the Holy Land, if you take a tour of Israel and visit En-Gedi, it is just breathtaking. Because out of this seemingly vast wasteland is this oasis that is full of blossoms and fruit, and it's just absolutely staggering. This is the description. This is the description. This is the woman's future husband. This is the one that she wants to marry. This is a song of love about him and about her. And finally, we're given somewhat of a culminating picture. Finally, the two of them are alone. They're walking in the country, and they decide to rest under an apple tree. They look at each other, gazing into each other's eyes, and the lover says to his beloved, "Behold, you are beautiful, my darling. Your eyes are like doves." And she says to him, "Oh, you are so handsome," and so on. They have fallen in love. It is mutual. They're both in this now, and they are telling each other so. And she says something about herself here in chapter 2, verse 1, that is really interesting. She says, "I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys." Now, it's the woman who's saying that, not the man. And I want to just point out the change that has taken place from the beginning of chapter 1 to the beginning of chapter 2. In chapter 1, in the beginning, the woman seemed unsure of herself, right? The fact that she was tanned, that she didn't maybe look quite right, the fact that she had been then forced out to do some hard labor and that she had seen some suffering, she was unsure of her looks and her demeanor. And now, all of a sudden, at the beginning of chapter 2, she seems to have gained this healthy measure of self-confidence. Something has happened between lover and beloved, and her self-esteem has actually risen. Love has done that. That is what love has done for her. She began to see herself as one who is loved. And that, brothers and sisters, can make all the difference in the world. I mean, of course, those of us who enjoy good marriages know that, and we're amazed by it every day. That someone should say that they want to spend the rest of their lives with us, and that they are still saying, "I want to spend the rest of my life with you. I want to grow old with you. I want to share my stories with you. I want to wake up in the morning and talk to you. I want to go to bed at night and appreciate that you're there." Of course, that's true. But those of us who have experienced the love of God in Jesus Christ know that as well. Charles Williams, who was a contemporary of J.R.R. Tolkien and who's the other guy? C.S. Lewis, right? He's a contemporary of those guys, and he wrote something kind of profound, I think. He said, "When we love someone, we see their eternal identity." And I think that there is something to that. You know, when you love someone, all the defects and imperfections seem to fall away and go to the side. Of course, you know that they're there. I mean, love is not in denial. You are aware of the faults of your spouse, and sometimes those faults rise to the surface and they need to be dealt with. But when you truly love someone, you forgive them their faults because you see something deeper. You see that person's eternal identity. Because that is what God's love for his people is all about. He sees our eternal identity. He sees who we have been created to be. He sees what we will be in glory. And that's what Jesus saw when he came and accomplished what he did in denying himself and becoming a human being, coming into this world to redeem us once and for all from our sin and from darkness and death. He too saw our imperfections and our faults, our sin and our rebellion against God the Father, which was self-destructive, but he chose to love us despite that. He chose to love us to perfection, saving us from everything and anything that would have condemned us. And he loved us right to the very end. And there is something of that to be seen and aspired to in the love between a man and a woman. And there we will leave it for this week. Let's bow our heads in prayer.